All right, guys, roll up your sleeves and turn up the radio. We have an interview that's geared to you. But ladies, don't tune out. You have to listen to this, too.
That's right. I'll be
too,
here.
BK. Thanks.
I'm here representing.
That's good.
It's 7:38. We're going to welcome into the show this morning Stephen Mansfield, and he is the New York Times bestselling author of books on faith history and contemporary culture. We recently had him on talking about Lincoln's battle with God. And the latest book is called Mansfield's Book of Manly Men. It's an utterly invigorating guide to being your most masculine self. Good morning, Stephen. Thank you for joining us.
Hey, it's my privilege. Good to be back with you.
Yeah, we're just going to have to ask you to explain yourself, really.
I know. It's like I'm picking a fight, isn't it?
I know. Everybody's like, what do you mean I'm not a man?
No, not at all. You know, I tell you where it comes from. Not only do I do a lot on college campuses, and I have young men, young millennials say, look, just tell me what to do. What does a man do? I don't want to be told that I got to heal up or go to therapy for 40 years. Just tell me what I'm supposed to do. So the millennials are a little less therapeutic, a little less, you know, kind of group and heal the soul kind of thing than their parents were, their boomer parents were. But the other thing that does it is watching the way manhood is framed on television. We've all seen the commercials.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the dad is doing a happy dance because he found the remote, and the kids are on the couch, the mom rolling their eyes, and then the dad gets a new insurance company. So what does he do? He dresses himself and the dog in orange. And I mean, it's just pitiful. And then I won't even go to the immoral side, which is, apparently every man is made to spend all of his life hanging around a strip club and somebody on a pole.
Mm-hmm.
And so none of this is true. We know that. But what does a man do? And I just thought, you know, I'm not the ideal man. Nobody is except Jesus. But the fact is that I thought we could distill out some principles, some lessons, some guides of behavior, some duties, and show young men especially what a man does, and then build a culture of men that sort of welcomes the young into that culture and helps them become the best men they can be. That's all we're trying to accomplish, although I'd like to have a little bit more fun, be a little less boring along the way.
Well, you do that well. Stephen, can you just tell us what was your moment? You said in your 40s, it wasn't until your 40s where you really felt like a man, almost for the first time. Talk about that.
Well, it's an odd way for a Christian pastor to get sort of accepted into manhood, but real briefly, I was on a big old trip to do good in the Middle East. I got stuck in Damascus, couldn't get out. This is, of course, before the recent war, so it was easier. After I was there a week, a friend of mine in the Syrian parliament, I know it sounds like I hang out with terrorists, but that was the kind of thing I was doing at the time, had a party for me on a hotel roof on a beautiful desert evening, and we couldn't communicate very well, and finally one of the guys said to me, do you have a son? And I said, yes. And he said, well, then you have a new name. And I asked him to explain. Apparently, in Arab culture, when a man has a son, his name is changed. He's spoken with the honorific of Abu and whatever his name is. So, you know, if your name is George or Bob or whatever, then your name is going to be, or I'm sorry, the son's name is, then your name is now going to be Abu Tom or Abu Bill, and that means father of. Well, my son's name is Jonathan, and so they said, well, your name is Abu John. And dancing broke out, and machine gun fire into the night, and great gobs of food. And I was kind of embarrassed by it at the beginning, and then we started dancing until 3 in the morning, that Arab man dance thing that's so much fun. And when they shoved me out the door, threw me back at my hotel in Damascus, something had changed in me. And I realized later it was the first time that anyone, understand, I'd graduated college, I'd been in ministry, I'd had 2 children, I'd been married, but no one had ever put an arm around me and said, welcome to the fellowship of men.
Hmm.
Welcome to what it means to be a man in this generation. We are with you. We will stand with you. We are proud of you. And congratulations. And I know it's silly, but it changed me. It changed me. I realized I was part of something historic. I realized I was part of something that could be of help, at least in theory. You know, I wasn't going to fly to Damascus to get pastoral advice, but still it was something very, very powerful in my life. And I thought, you know what? We should have Christian versions of bar mitzvahs. We should have sort of the man group in the average, not just church, but everywhere. And I was thankful for the earlier men's movement, but I found it to be, not only had it passed from the scene, but it was a little therapeutic, a little bit oriented toward the boomers, and I thought, there's something younger, cooler, and more external that we need to have now.
It speaks to the power of fellowship, I think, too, and just having other, you know, brothers really there celebrating that with you. That's quite amazing.
Yeah, you know, it really is the way most cultures work. I mean, I moved from PC to Mac, And all I did was start using it, and then all these other people at the coffee shop just said, "Hey, no, if, you know, if you push that button and do that,
right.
Hey, man, that worked." I never went to college. I never read a book. People just absorbed me.
Mm-hmm.
I went to a racquetball match once because I play a little racquetball, and all of a sudden, some guy came up and said, "Now, what drink do you want tonight?" And how do you like your ribs? And all I had done was sign up for a racquetball thing. After a while, somebody handed me their baby and said, "Hey, would you hold this child?" And I realized that I was being absorbed into a culture. Just broad, and people just assumed I wanted to be there, and they were part of it. Here, stir this, hold that. How do you want your ribs? And I thought, man, that's what men just need, to have a culture that's dynamic and thriving and that draws others in and that's turned towards initiating the young. And so all of these things were things I'm hoping to come out of this book.
Now, we've talked with John Eldridge, of course, and you reference Wild at Heart as well in your book. How does this play into that? Because a lot of that ends up being father to son and that sort of thing. Can we take that to another level and accomplish, without going to Syria, what you experienced?
You know, I actually envision eventually conferences where a man and a family brings all the males, and they actually experience the conference together as males, together. And, you know, I think that's important because the boomer version was a man and a few of his friends, and it was very therapeutic, and it was lots of speaking. I want to see more doing, less speaking. I want to see it be tribal in the sense that, you know, I'm not old enough yet, but if I had 5 sons and 16 sons-in-law or whatever, we would go to this thing together. And the result would be, of course, that we would have servanthood and a man's responsibility to tend his field and, you know, the man's responsibility to tend the souls of those who are assigned to him, so to speak, as Scripture says. Women would be thrilled for their men to go to this thing. And when they came back, they wouldn't come back, you know, with a new agenda and hyper loving. You know, some women were almost put off by the earlier men's movie because the guys thought they got really romantic. You know, no, it'd be a matter of taking responsibility for their household and for their field. And so I think there's a slightly different way to do it. I think the earlier movement was great. We're all trying to build on biblical values. There's just a new generation in the field now, and I think they need a different approach.
I agree. I think this is very timely. We're talking with Stephen Mansfield. His book is called Mansfield's Book of Manly Men. And Stephen, when we come back in just a moment, let's run through your 4 maxims and how those apply to our lives and just kind of put some spiritual principles to these too and give our men that are listening maybe a few how-tos and some different things that we can do. So we'll be back with more with Stephen Mansfield in just a moment. It's Faith Radio Mornings.
There is hope for every man. It's 7:49, Faith Radio Mornings with Fed and PK continues as we continue our conversation with Stephen Mansfield, New York Times bestselling author, and we're talking about his book, Mansfield's Book of Manly Men, an utterly invigorating guide to being your most masculine self. Thanks for sticking with us, Stephen.
You betcha.
Well, I love the quote, too, that you start the book with from Norman Mailer, of all people, but he says, masculinity is not something given to you, but something you gain, and you gain it by winning small battles with honor. So let's dive right into the 4 manly maxims.
Well, first, I wanted to keep this so simple. I wanted it to be like a McDonald's. You know, you go in, they've got the exact plan. But the first one is manly men do manly things. Now, obviously, we're having some fun with this manly language, you know. but manly men do manly things. What does that mean? That manliness, more than it's any other single thing, is a man assuming his responsibilities and doing the duties, doing the things he's responsible to do, just doing.
Mm-hmm.
And men get this. If you put a bunch of men in a room and you say, feel something, if you say put a bunch of men in a room and say you got to hug each other a lot and sit around and stare meaningfully into each other's eyes, you'll have about one man the following week. Men want to do, they need to do, they just need to know what to do. So what I do in the book is take out of the lives of some of the great men of history some of the duties. It's about having a band of brothers. It's about going after expansion and growth in your life and for the sake of your family. It's about realizing the field assigned to you. I'll talk about that in a minute, and knowing what you're meant to tend. It's about essentially accepting the idea that you are here and you have the gifts that you have so that you can serve those who are given to you and accomplish things. Be be a certain quality of person who can accomplish a certain type of goal, and that goal is essentially in the service of others. So that mentality, that being a man is not about entitlement, it's not about pleasures, it's not about looks, it's not about all the things that I kind of blow up in the book, it is about accepting your role and at a certain body of duties. And when you tell that, I'll tell you what, to the young, they get it. They really do get it. They can see that better than they can see, you know, you need to spend 30 years getting over your father wound, as important as that was, by the way, in those days of the
right.
movement.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Well, and obviously this stretches into every area of life. I think it might be easy for guys to kind of turn it on at work and be the guy that's making decisions and getting things done, but then coming home and being totally selfish and ignoring the family. You talk about how it reaches into areas of family, work, play even, faith, and more too, right?
Absolutely. The second principle is manly men tend their field. And I take this, even though the book is intended for a wide variety of people, and certainly who are Christians, but others are feeding from this as well. But Paul said, I'm not going to boast beyond the field assigned to me. And there's exact language in Greek that says, essentially, at any point in your life, you have a certain field that is assigned to you. It's the total body of responsibilities that God has given you. So I have a wife, and I have two college-age children, and I have a home and property and, you know, a ministry and business and a writing life and obligations and et cetera. And so this is the field that I tend. And, if, of course, if we cram too much into that field, we're going to be under-empowered and weak and stressed and so on. The art is to find out, what has God assigned to me? What am I given to do in this season of my life? There's grace for that, number one. But number two, that's what I'm required to attend. And I take this to the extreme because it helps me. If my wife and I walk in the door in the evening after an event and I notice there's a light bulb out, I don't feel pressure, and I don't feel, you know, worked hard, and as they say in Texas, rode hard and put up wet, but I just simply go replace the light bulb. Everything is my responsibility to either do or make sure gets done. And so my wife's not the one dealing with the contractor. She's not the one having to, although she's a very competent woman, I make sure that I tend the field. And that includes tending her. That includes tending the kids. If I notice there's some little dark quark in my daughter's soul, or my son's retreating a bit, and, you know, they're in their 20s, so they're adults, but still, I'm their father. If I notice my wife, whatever, from putting on some weight to being a little unhealthy to feeling lonely, you know, because of the distance from her friends or something, all of that, it's not maybe mine to solve, it is mine to care about and make sure is being solved. And that attitude of responsibility, I mean, what's the typical image of a male? It's the bubba sitting at the in the Barco lounger, you know, the recliner, you know, drinking his beer in a torn T-shirt and telling somebody to get him a sandwich. Mm-hmm. Irresponsibility. Manhood as entitlement rather than manhood as an obligation to care for others.
And I think there's an element there, too. And I, again, speaking as the woman, okay, I hate to tread into this, but is there ever a time, I've seen it with friends and that sort of thing, where you kind of resent it in a way that you have to be the man? Do you see that kind of pervasive too? It's like, why do I always have to change the light bulb? But your whole thing is changing that, right? Changing the heart.
Well, I'm emphasizing, yes, it is changing the heart. I emphasize the entire issue of servanthood, mm-hmm. and duties, because that's been underemphasized. But let me tell you what, I believe in the glory of being a man. I love the fact that I am a man. I love what God has given me to do. I love the way I connect to other men, the way I'm mission-oriented, meaning, you know, task, let's do things, let's build things, let's change things. I love turning towards the young and saying, come on, let me tell you how to avoid some of the pitfalls and to be a great and a godly man. And so, there is a, if you only do the duty part, well, you're the man, so you got to go shovel this, or you're the man, so you got to go talk to him, you know. Well, that's a thin version of it. Mm-hmm. But a man who has to, he will have duties, he will have things he's got to do. He may have to get up and shovel snow at 3 a.m. so everybody can get where they need to go, and on and on and on. But I'm telling you, being a man is an awesome thing. And if you celebrate both of those at the same time, that being a man is something wonderful, it's a gift to women, it's a gift to children, it's a gift to nations. We need men and women, both healthy, both thriving, both running on full steam to build great societies. Then I think men begin, they stand their ground and tend their field, and they do it with joy and passion. And it's just that we've had a very thin understanding of what manhood really is in this culture.
Mm-hmm. And about 3 minutes left to get the last two maxims in quickly. What's number three?
Number three is that manly men make manly men. Now, I'm an academic by background. I've got a doctorate and all that. But I'll tell you, you don't really make men by sitting them to seminars or setting them in a room and having them look at each other and talk about their wounds. You make men, you make manly men by having a vital culture of men who love each other, who work together, who are sort of like the pack on the Dog Whisperer. You know, mm-hmm. If they see something wrong with the dude, they go, rah, 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 you know, kind of deal with it. You know, it's meant to be, you know, I like it when the Bible says, when you're in the way, talk to your son. Doesn't mean take him in a room, chain him to a chair, and talk to him for 9 hours. It means while you're taking him somewhere, address this thing with him. And then finally, I say that manly men live to the glory of God. And that's not because I'm trying to put a Christian spin on it. It is that I believe that men cannot fulfill what they're called to fulfill in this generation or any time in history without the help of God, without the energy and the resources and the wisdom of God. And also, I think that men who stand around looking for applause from human beings will never accomplish what they're meant to do. A lot of what we have to do, we just do it. Why? We're men and we're called to. And do we wait for applause from our wives and our kids? You know what? You're not always going to get it. Sometimes on Saturday morning, my job is to tick off everybody as we move towards doing the right thing. The applause comes from heaven, and when you live that way, you stop being quite so insecure and mealy-mouthed, and you do what you're called to do out of the love of God and a love of those you're meant to tend.
Here's a loaded question with only a minute left, but as a woman, can women help their men to step up and to just really fulfill this role as a man? What if they don't want to or they don't know how to? What would you suggest for one point for a woman if she's frustrated with her husband?
I'll say one thing real quick, and then I think I'm going to make that my next book, so I'm going to keep all kinds of secrets.
Okay.
It's a whole marketing point. No, I'm
kidding. Yeah, right.
The one thing that women don't understand is even if their man is just a big old gorilla dude, he lives and dies on her words. You know, David said of Jonathan, his love to me was like that of a woman. And, of course, a lot of people have turned that into a gay relationship, which doesn't fit mm-hmm. the context at all. I believe what David was saying was Jonathan spoke words that inspired me. We read where Jonathan helped him help David find his strength in God. If women would just, I'm talking about women in marriage now,
yep.
just find something they can say kind every day, this thing will get better and better if the man is serious about being a righteous, manly man. Because those words live in a man's soul who thinks about them all day. And often when he's walking around mad, he's mad about the last thing you said, because what men do, and here's the great key, and then I'm going to hang up and go find bodyguards because I'm not supposed to give this man's secret away. The thing is, men mask hurt with anger. So most men who appear angry are actually deeply hurt, and they're usually hurt by something their spouse has said.
Yeah.
Wow.
Wish we had more time. We're up against mm-hmm. the clock. But, Stephen, thank you so much. We have links for the book at myfaithradio.com. God bless you, Stephen.
Mm-hmm.
Hey, great talking to you guys.
You too. Thanks so much.